So our experience has been nothing bad has happened. It has increased our ability to attract and retain patients. And we think that the economy going forward is going to be much more patient-centric than the past. So having data liquidity across patients, providers, and payers is the right thing to do.
John Glasser, you certainly heralded the or led the efforts toward patient gateway in the partner system. And again, it's a similar sort of model. It's really allowed patients to access their medical records. And yet, I know it doesn't allow patients to get to everything. And there's been some resistance on some fronts. Why don't you respond to the question, but certainly keeping that whole project in mind, I think, would be of interest to us.
Yeah, I think you can answer a broader perspective on the comments that Jason made in the work that he, Clay Christensen, and others have done, which is extraordinary work, et cetera. What's not clear to me is how the magnitude of the disruption over what period of time, and whether it's very short, the sort of atomic bomb goes off and the world's a different place, even if a short period of time is a decade, all about something along that. Clearly society moves and it can be radically different over longer periods of time following a more incremental path. And it's just not clear to me which of these we'll see. I think there are a number of forces, and I'm not a student necessarily of all this, that mitigate this, realizing that extension of these systems to the patients is a given, and the movement to payment based on quality of performance is a given, and the proliferation of care settings such as MinuteClinic and targeted specialty hospitals is probably a given too. But nonetheless, I think there is an extraordinary amount of innovation in medicine. So as stuff moves out into the outpatient setting, like basic surgery, for example, there is this accumulation of new knowledge, new technology on the other side of it. And so the notion that the hospital will disappear, assumes that there's no new innovation coming in, or which it's the right focal point to do. An example of that, if you look at the amount of refereed articles in Medline a decade ago, it was about 350,000, now it's double that this year. So there's just this extraordinary movement in and then moving out as it follows the curve that Jason talked about. I think the second is, one of the things that sort of struck me, or initially listening to this, is the Mass General in about 2 years will be 200 years old. It has survived for 200 years through extraordinary changes in society, medicine, and all kinds of other stuff. Nothing disrupted it to the point where it's gone. It's not a death, it's not a crime, or things like that. Why is that? And you could even, being raised in a Catholic, why is the Roman Catholic Church as an organization around for 1,500 years, despite extraordinary activity? So part of it is, I suspect, that in a lot of the cases where disruptions occurred, there's been a single innovation that went right to the jugular and took it out. But you have organizations that innovate across this huge spectrum. No single intervention will do that short of dramatic payment reform, which alters the interface. The technology might not do that. The third is, these are often social economic goods. They're more than an economic good. Society will put up with a company going out. It gets squeezed if a local community hospital is going to go south. And so it protects in certain ways, whether for altruistic reasons or employment reasons or whatever. So there's a number of mitigating factors into which you could also add the regulatory environment, which can make certain things hard to move and hard to move rather dramatically here. So anyway, I think there's a number of forces. We will see clear change on this, one of which involves patient gateway or the equivalent that John and colleagues have, or a number of you all in the audience might have. I think they will make the world a better place. It will play to a lot of these forces. How disruptive that will be in the next multiple years, that's just not clear.
Thank you. Peter, if you want to react not only to Jason's presentation, but to the comments that have just been made.
Well, sure. I'm a real believer in data liquidity. We're working hard to make that happen. As an innovator, I study what Clay and Jason have proposed, and think about, is there an opportunity in the United States to really be disruptive? And will information in and of itself be enough of a differentiator to meet that disruption? And I think the answer is probably no. And as a society, we have to ask ourselves some questions. If we really are trying to get control of the cost curve, and the cost curve is about enabling new types of behavior across the supply chain to help delivery and consumption chain, how is that going to happen if we have this rigidity on the supply side, on the payment side? And when you look at the model, I think one of the important things is that the innovation happens with non-consumers. And when you think on a global basis as opposed to just a US basis, there's a lot of non-consumers of health outside the US. And you see lots of innovation happening where there are new ways to solve problems, either with value-added business processes that work super well in certain environments as in India, or whether information management might be very different because you don't have quite the same infrastructure in place. So the new value networks that are part of the model, I think, are going to happen outside the US, which may be a good thing, because then they can be re-imported once we have some knowledge about how they work. But as the entrepreneur, innovator, you have to say, where should we put our investments? And how do we think about, how do we build technology that can work in non-US, non-developed markets and still be applicable here where most of the dollars are? And so it's really complicated, but really fascinating to try to apply that model to innovation in health, but on a global basis.
Thank you. Jim, reactions.
One of the things I found most interesting in the innovator's prescription, it wasn't covered specifically in the presentation today, was the area of diagnostic tests and medicines. And certainly today, those are treated as very separate things. So you get the tests and pay for it, and if you need the medicine, you pay for the medicine. And I think one of the disruptions that might be interesting to explore is perhaps the idea of you pay for the diagnostic test, and if you need the medicine, you get it for free. Or conversely, anyone who is a candidate for getting the diagnostic test gets it for free, and then if you need the medicine, you pay for the medicine. Now, in the current model, that wouldn't work from a revenue arrangement, but perhaps there are some interesting models we could explore around either revenue sharing or new business models that bring the diagnostic test and the medicine together in some ways that can benefit patients.
The other panelists, John, Peter, what's your reaction to that?
Yeah, certainly I look at the need in our information economy to inform patients so they can make rational decisions based on the data that we're giving them. One of the things I describe is giving patients just access to data is not very helpful. You need information, you need knowledge, you need wisdom. So I think we will see this new set of what I'll call decision support service provided organizations that take all of this data that I've talked about making liquid and then apply it with, say, best practices from hospital systems, best practices from other patients, and then help patients make rational decisions about the medicines or the treatments that they might find most beneficial, understanding some of the risks.
Peter?
I completely agree with John. We think that there is the opportunity for these value-added services to exist to help people make more rational decisions. If they can't make rational decisions due to lack of context, capability, knowledge, education, there will be these new service providers that will do that, and will do that in a very consumer-friendly way. You see that all the time. You don't just go out and buy a car based on what a salesman does. You go out and look at some third-party services that have done some rating, done some information, done some studies to evaluate that. There's no reason to believe that health consumption can't be similar to that in complex decision-making. I think an interesting question that Jim raised is, why are some things reimbursed at different rates, right? Why, if you believe in the precision medicine part of the model in innovative prescription, and you look at the investments in diagnostics today, they have a hard problem because the return on that investment isn't the same given the business models of drugs and diagnostics. That's something that's framed by our reimbursement system, not necessarily rational given the benefits that if you could really unequivocally prove that this is the problem, you'll know what the right set of outcomes or procedures are to do. And so we need to invest more in diagnostics. But there isn't the business model today, and it's a question that doesn't get discussed very often, but it's really fascinating when we think about how do we get to personalized medicine? Because you've really got to invest in a bunch of stuff, both infrastructure and IP at the second, infrastructure and information technology and testing, and then IP protection and business model. And I don't frankly see how that innovation and conversation is going to happen.
Yeah, I think a couple thoughts regarding a number of the points here made. Clearly, there is starting to form in D.C. as a result of a lot of focus has been on the near-term unleashing of ERA funds for interoperable electronic health records involving meaningful use, kind of like a bumper sticker on most cars in the HIT community.
I think it's under four.
I feel like it, Peter. I've read something or anything. You know, conversations about some of the things that are coming, and whether it's the personalized medicine revolution and leveraging EHR data as a phenotype and arriving at much more better ability to be prescriptive about whether this treatment will work or whether you're at greater risk of this disease, et cetera. There is a huge amount of collateral issues that go with it, whether they're reimbursement or privacy or some of the innovative ways of financing here. I think it's complicated, as we all know, to move through that. But on the other hand, this wave is coming, and it's coming with some reasonable force here. And so we have to deal with it despite the complexity. So I think we will start to have to tackle some of these things, and perhaps after Congress finishes up healthcare reform and then nails immigration, it may come back to this particular topic here. I think the other thought I have is, you know, when I look at the sort of broadly what's occurring across the landscape, there are two fundamental forces at play. One is this notion of accountability, where the providers are increasingly accountable for the care that they deliver, quality, its efficiency, et cetera. And to the degree that it's prudent, we as individuals become more accountable for this. And lots of ways you can affect those. But that's force number one. And force number two, nobody really knows what the adoption rate of the EHRs will be, but it's going to be higher, and there will be liquidity. And so the impact of that, combined with the other things, kind of here. We can engineer those two, hard, complicated, you know, social, political, reimbursement, technology engineering phenomena. The thing that I'd be prepared for is the second, third order effects, which are really hard to see. And an example is, if you go way back to the turn of the century, and where the automobile was created, I had the first order effect of capital labor substitution, shoot the horse, drive the car, pollute the street in a different way. Yeah. But nobody saw at that time the advent of the suburbs or the vacation industry like at Disney World or a wide variety of stuff or the unleashing of interstate commerce that would parallel that. So I think these two forces will have sequelae, which are a challenge to really understand and might result in the world being very different as a result of a large number of innovative individual actions that go on along the way. Last comment, and I sometimes wonder in our own efforts to educate patients, I sometimes think that there's this almost 2x2 matrix, and on one axis, let's say the y-axis, is how comfortable I feel with my ability to make a decision, sort of read it, make my own conclusion about what's going on, et cetera. Do I feel like I'm a smart guy, I'm smart enough to do that? And the other axis is the risk of being wrong, and if the risk of being wrong is low or high. So, if I eat a couple of Taco Bell burritos and I get a pain in my stomach, I'm pretty clear I know enough to know what's going on, and if I'm wrong, the risk is pretty low. But if I've got some scary growth on on my skin or wherever, I'm not sure that no matter what I read, I'm going to feel smart enough to do this, and if I'm wrong, the consequences. So we may be able to deal with the lower self quite well. I'm not sure we will ever deal with the upper self quite well, although what's unclear to me is whether communities on the web, in effect, provide that knowledge and so become a surrogate for the smart physician who's at any one of our institutions here. So there'll be a real limit. It's probably on people's cognitive ability, willingness to do all this stuff, to go off and really be educated about their health and be engaged and like that.
Let me ask a question to all of you. In this era that we're living in, we're seeing primary care very overloaded to the point where there's no room in panels anymore. The ability to take in new patients is very limited and very stressed. And primary care providers are actually leaving the field. Their ranks are going down. And some of the ideas that are out there right now is for primary care to actually focus on certain types of more critical functions as opposed to all the things that they work on now. And that really is suggesting a move toward more of a of nurse practitioners having greater accountability. Other people in the office setting really doing more things. That, in a sense, is a version of a disruptive model to some degree. And I guess my question for all of you is, if that continues down the road, do you see actually the specialties really actually doing only specific things and then the rest of care being provided by other groups? What's your thinking on that?
Well, just to amplify that whole notion of decision support service providers, one of the things that John and I have had based in Boston. When you go to order a Hen CT or an MRI or a PET scan, you have to get on the phone for 20 minutes and argue with a triage clerk on the other side of the insurance company to decide whether it's an appropriate test or not. Well, wouldn't it be rational if there's a script and that's a triage person's hands to codify that into an XML structure and actually do real-time decision support so you don't have a phone call? Well, if you can do real-time decision support, that is the 1,000 best rules of radiology testing, then do I actually need the clinician who's the highly trained primary care doc to order that test, or could an extender order that test based on evidence? So I think there's some aspects of care that we can now push off to trained people, but lesser trained people through the use of decision support.
I had a couple of reactions to the proposed disaggregation of primary care that was in the innovator's prescription. I think there's a lot to be said for it. There were the three elements to it, where the primary care physician continues to do that diagnostic fee-for-service part of it. The more precision medicine pieces go off to the nurse practitioners, the PAs, the minute clinics, and then the chronic care patients get turned over to the disease management companies on a kind of per member per month basis. And then some of the things that were formerly done by specialists, when there's imaging and diagnostics equipment that is feasible to put in the doctor's office, those can then move down from the specialist into primary care. Two considerations associated with that, though. Disease management has turned out to be harder in practice than originally thought. So certainly conditions like congestive heart failure, the ROI is pretty clear on doing disease management. In some of the other areas, it's been more difficult to show the ROI, and therefore it's been a challenge to some of the disease management companies as to how they scale these things on a profitable basis and therefore have a sustainable business model. And then the second point I would make relating to that is going to be the timing as to when these services currently done by specialists can move into the primary care environment. Because if we move things out to the minute clinics and the disease management companies sooner, and then the things coming down from the specialists happen later in time, it may be difficult for the primary care practice to be sustainable as a business model during that interim period.
I think it's a really interesting question on a variety of fronts. One question that Buck Galvin asks at GE is, should we have a conversation about how many primary care doctors we need in this country to try to bend the cost curve? That's an interesting question. I have a bunch of docs on my staff, and many of them say, don't believe that primary care physicians can really handle it, and that they actually think primary care will go away with these decisions and support tools, and people can triage themselves effectively into specialists. When you think about the amount of knowledge that is happening, the belief that a primary care physician, I'm not a doctor, a primary care physician can keep up with the increase in knowledge is an interesting question. And so should we count on more primary care as most countries outside the United States are? Or should we say that's something that can be rules-based so that you can use decision support of another form and move people into specialists, which has been the trend for the last 38 years because of increases in knowledge? It's something I'd like the docs to give me a perspective on.
I think we obviously do something about primary care. Too few students going into it coming out of medical school relative to the need. What we saw in Massachusetts and we'll see as a result of health care reform, when you expand the coverage, you create a whole new wave of demand for these folks. And we're getting crushed now, and we'll continue to get crushed. So I think the notion of moving tasks off to skilled healthcare professionals who can write prescriptions, do a lot of fundamental activity that do not require medical school residency and all that other stuff here is just very smart. Frankly, got to happen. Otherwise, we will deny care fundamentally through a perverse form of ration. You just can't get in to see a bunch of these folks. So that will have to occur, and particularly if we move to this model of medical home where we introduce a care coordination accountability. I'm not sure you need to be the MD to keep track of whether Mrs. Smith is keeping her appointments or taking these medications or whatever, but somebody's got to inherit that role and somebody in the practice. So we have to do something because the care coordination demands and the sheer our lack of supply, so to speak, here, so we're coming here. Having been involved with decision support for 1,000 years of partners, I'm a huge believer in its potency, but I'm also, and maybe I'm just a scarred old guy, a little sanguine about it at times here. We can get pretty darn good decision support about medication use. Getting radiology is a little hard, frankly, to go off and do. So I'd be careful about how much we can really do to guide this. This doesn't mean we can't do a lot, but I'd be real careful about how much we could give a smart person who's got some nursing training or whatever and make a whole bunch of calls that a physician makes. I think the other thing to remember, too, is a lot of the conversation with the provider, yes, it's fact-based, choices A versus B, rational or otherwise, but a lot of it is just listening and discussions of emotions and consequences, and it requires, I think, the human element to seeing the look on the face, the color of the skin, and for a lot of people, this is not a dry transaction. Let's go to Zagat's and find the, you know, the cheapest restaurant with, you know, whatever the scores are we have for services, that or the other, and read a couple of reviews. You want to talk to a person. In the same way they'll want to talk to a priest or a rabbi or a lawyer about certain complicated decisions that they are facing, et cetera. So we will probably never be able to replace, or shouldn't try, frankly, to obviate that human element, and we ought to respect it because it's an integral part of the patient.
Let me put a point of fact in here. When we look at our malpractice data in the Harvard system, Risk Management Foundation, primary care is the most frequently sued group nowadays, and they're accounting for the greatest amount of malpractice dollars in the Harvard system. And it's largely for missed and delayed cancer diagnosis. So the decision support piece is huge, and whether or not that's really being made available to them is a real, or whether or not they're even accessing decision support is a real question. But that leads me to another question here, and I guess I'm gonna throw a word at you, and that's variability. When we look at these malpractice cases, we see variability all over the place. We see variability in cognition. We see variability in the knowledge skills of the providers, even their, not only knowledge, but in their ability to perform procedures. And then we also see variability in the value they place on certain treatment paths. So there are differences there. And you go from one physician to another, and you're looking for the standard of care, and you're seeing variability. Going back to Peter's presentation, the patients are highly variable. And we certainly see that in the malpractice cases. We see variability of knowledge, no question about that. That's right at the top of the list. But we also see variability in what's important to them. And that often plays out in why they sue later on. And that's really around patient expectations. And then we see variability in how they make their own decisions and how that really feeds it. So my question for you is variability going to be the big problem here? I think other industries have been able to really kind of reinvent themselves, but I'm not sure they've had the complexity and variability that healthcare really sees on an everyday sort of basis. So let me have each of you respond to that.
Well, so there's two personal stories about variability. So as a fourth human to have been fully genetically sequenced, I actually understand a whole lot of my probabilities of disease. So I have twice the average risk of a human male developing prostate cancer in my life. So, well, knowing that most men die with prostate cancer than from prostate cancer, at least personally, it doesn't bother me so much. It doesn't create a lot of anxiety. So having a set of probabilities associated with disease states I might develop helps me be more rational in my thinking.
Yep.
About 7 years ago, I went to my clinician, my primary care doc, and he said, your body mass index is 32, your blood pressure is, 160 over 90. We're going to put you on lipitors, inhibitors, beta blockers, and $700 a month of metabolic poisons. To which I said, that doesn't sound very alluring to me. Why don't I change my lifestyle? And he said, oh, that never works. you'll lose 25 pounds, then you gain 30. So I went from the two lattes a day, supersized this or that, food on the run, to chicken fish, to vegetarianism, to veganism, and today I have four food groups, grains, legumes, vegetables, and fruits, and green tea, that's it. I have no caffeine, etc. And so now my body mass index is 20. And all of that occurred because I had an adversity to taking a lot of things that I thought were really not fixing the underlying problem, but poisoning my system. So, we hope that with enough knowledge, you can reduce the variability, both genetic knowledge and then reading literature and understand risks of eating some of the diets that Peter talked about.
John?
Just to show you the difference, I had a couple of years ago, my doc cholesterol is high. Second time we've done it, so we lost the oil. She said, well, we got to one issue, you can eat better, you know, all this stuff. And I said, what does that mean? Well, you know, no cheeseburgers, no ice cream. Or what's option is plan B. Plan B, you can take a stat. So any side effects of the stat? I said, well, we'll do a liver test, but we're usually not. I said, plan B works for me, my man. So I'm happy to go with A. And the fast food industry. I'm a full, I'm trying to do my American way of raising the economy. I think the sort of core orientation, and this guided a lot of the decision support work as partners, is variability per se isn't bad. And it's not obvious that when you look at variability that you actually know what it ought to be, because you can have legitimate differences of opinions or heuristics and no data to guide you other than my experience versus yours and a variety of other things here. This is not making TV sets. We can have a highly specifiable process with a known and highly measurable output in a lot of cases, and you can also control to a very large degree the quality and the nature of the inputs going into the process here. However, there are two categories where that's not true. One is where there is a known path, a fairly agreed upon path, and whether it's seeing, you know, a middle-aged male with some frequency who's got high blood pressure or whatever, there's not a whole, or American Diabetes Association guidelines, there's not a whole lot of argument, why are we doing something different about that? So in some cases where there is a known path, this is the question is why is it? The second, there are some forms of variability which are, quote, out of bounds. So, you know, ordering two medications which have significant contraindications, what in the world is this all about? I mean, that's just out of bounds. And so to a large degree, a lot of the decisions forward at partners are saying if you have the range of activities a physician or a care team will go on, and they'll bounce around and they'll all be different here. You can't cross this line and you can't cross this line. So decision support is looking at boundary problems where you do something that is clearly risky or negligent, or, and it can be an act of commission, it can be an act of omission, it can be a temporal interval that is too long or too short, et cetera. So it isn't trying to eradicate variability per se. It's trying to get rid of some variability which is truly bad news and other variability where there's clear evidence guidelines about how it ought to work.
I think another important part here is to, again, bring the consumer into it. And I think consumer choice and information is important when they make choices about where to have procedures done. I think this is clearest in the value-added process procedure space. And that we have to go back to the business model question, because I think John's right, is that the community hospital gets protected by the community, but perhaps on a false set of assumptions. That, oh geez, I'd much rather be close by to have my hip replaced, when in fact maybe they do three in a year, where I might be a lot better off if I feel a long ways away, went somewhere where a person did 2,000 a year and came back. And those are very difficult but important questions that the only way we're going to get to a political consensus is if we have some knowledge base that says, oh, here's the choice of saving your community hospital and the risk that you're taking by going into one of three versus the alternative. The problem is people don't know, well, if my community hospital isn't there, what's going to be there for when I need the ED or whatever the equivalent is of something in my community? And it's that disruption outcome of what's the future going to look like that makes the status quo so rigid. Yet we know it's probably not in our best interest overall as a part of the system point of view. And I think those are some interesting questions.
Jim, what's your thinking on this? Well, I'd like to begin by saying I agree with John Palombo that diet and exercise and a healthy lifestyle should always be your first course of action in cases like this. If that does prove insufficient, there are medicines that can avoid more serious consequences. I'd actually like to answer a broader question about Dr. Ubel's work, because I found the book to be fascinating in many ways. It's a 225-page book, and in the first 200 pages, he does apply behavioral economics to the question of consumer behavior and physician behavior, and shows where the market doesn't always lead to good outcomes, as we would define good outcomes. But I think it's important to focus on the last 25 pages in the book, which he alluded to in the final couple of slides of his presentation, which were around some things we could do in the regulatory and legislative area. And he tosses out a variety of different ideas in there, tax cities, subsidies, restrictions, bans, and the like. But I think it's important to note that one of the things that he did not do in those 25 pages in the presentation was demonstrate how those particular remedies would be superior to the kinds of approaches that the market is taking to them. And I think part of the reason for that is if you do believe the premise that people sometimes make irrational decisions, then you also have to apply that to politicians and regulators as well, and recognize that although we might have in mind the ideal public policy or the ideal piece of legislation or regulation, it rarely turns out that way when it winds its way through the legislative process. So the tax on soda has come up recently as a possible way to change behavior. And a couple of things there. First of all, the Senate Finance Committee is talking about a tax of something like 3 cents per can, which I think everybody recognizes is not going to materially change behavior. The reason it's still on the table is it because it potentially brings in $25 billion in additional revenue that wasn't there before. And so the motivations are often not for health reasons, but for other reasons as well. With regard to things like subsidies of fitness centers, these sound like great ideas. What often happens in these situations is that when fitness centers see that their business models are being subsidized, they tend to raise their rates. This is one of the reasons why college education continues to increase at rates much more rapid than inflation. It's because of the subsidies associated with student loans. So one of the things I'm hoping is that perhaps he'll write a sequel to the book called Government Mandated Madness, in which he'll spend 200 pages going through the irrational behaviors that result in some of the legislation and regulation that's been talked about over the past couple of days that we're trying to undo in order to get to some of these new business models.
We have just a couple more minutes. I want to open it up to the audience for any questions for our panelists. Yes, go ahead, number two.
I just wanted to point out in the spirit of innovation, disruptive technologies, and consumer perception, I just want to draw attention to the fact that we haven't heard from a single woman today. Really, the moderators at this conference are women. Many panels are exclusively women, and exclusively men. The moderators are exclusively men. Keynoters tend to be men. I just want to point out that this is an important conference. I find it intellectually stimulating, intellectually challenging. And I think it's important, since you are setting the agenda for public policy, technology and healthcare, that we do appreciate a little bit more representation, that dreaded diversity word, because it does affect how we feel. Like, after a while, you just kind of stop listening if you feel that you're not being represented or that you're just not feeling your valued. And I appreciate, I wonder if any of you just noticed, I wonder if any of the audience members have noticed that yesterday that was the case, today will be the case. And I just hope the next year that won't be the case.
Thank you. That was a point well taken. I appreciate those comments. Yes, go ahead. Number two again.
My name is Steve Block. I'd like to propose that behavioral medicine is actually a disruptive innovation. And point out that although the CDC identifies behavioral factors as accounting for 50% of morbidity and mortality, only 7% of the NIH budget goes for behavioral sciences. So with that as a backdrop, what I'd like to suggest is that the failure of the Medicare support, the CMS-supported disease management programs that led to the demise of that program, the demonstration projects, could be accounted for by the failure to adequately integrate to adequately address behavioral factors and behavioral comorbidities, such as comorbid depression and so forth, in the management of those patients in those projects. That being said, to the degree that that's true, what would the panelists say about the opportunities for reintegrating behavioral medicine into primary care and chronic condition management. What are the levers, what are the incentives that need to be addressed in order to catalyze that process?
We're almost out of time, so why don't just one person maybe take that on, or do that?
So Steve, very briefly, I see a concierge medicine physician, and this purely accidentally, I was grandfathered in, I don't pay, but when I go to see him, he spends an hour with me, and we talk actually about the mental health issues, the behavioral issues. He thinks of me not as a chief complaint, but actually, what is the lifestyle that we need to look at to treat you as a whole human? And he does it because he has an hour with me and he can afford to do that. So I agree with you. What we need to do is give doctors the luxury of the time that is needed to look at the whole human, including behavioral health.
Thank you. One last question, comment.
Could you comment real quickly on the view why we have not been able to get greater success with the doc-in-a-box clinics, given the fact that everybody's trying to move the services to the outer rims and operating almost like at a below break-even point?
I think if you look at Clay's work, there's another piece of it that has to happen. It's really about the interfaces that exist between the bundle. So when Jason put up that last chart, it's about where does it fit within the bundle? And it's very hard to disrupt in just one segment. And it's about people trying to say, oh, I need to get a host of services. And if I'm just going to get one piece here of the value chain, it may not be enough. And so his notion there, which I think is hard to figure out, is how can those doc-in-a-box get vertically integrated with other parts of the solution so that there's a total value chain component that then people can consume. Right now it's too niche. They need to integrate with other pieces, and they're trying to do that, but it's hard.
Please join me in thanking our panelists.